Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week, George Eaton will be reporting from Edinburgh on the fallout from the Scottish independence referendum. Then I'll be talking to John Elledge and Philip Maughan about whether or not English regions might ask for more powers. And finally, Fiona Rutherford, Ian Steadman and I will talk about the private companies that want to take humans into space.
I'm Caroline Crampton, the New Statesman's web editor, and I'm talking to George Eaton, our political editor, who is up in Edinburgh, having been up all night covering the Scottish referendum result. So hello, George.
Hello.
So, George, just before we get into some of the issues that have come out of this, just summarise what happened overnight for us.
So in the end, it was a comfortable win for no. It was 55-45. We knew the results before they'd finished counting. It was over for yes. You could see in Salmond's concession speech that he was disappointed that the momentum they seemed to have at one point when they briefly went ahead didn't carry through. They lost by more than the final poll suggested. It does seem as if there was a Shiloh effect where people weren't prepared to tell pollsters that they were going to vote no, but were prepared to vote no in the privacy of the ballot box. And the yes side, although they took Dundee and Glasgow, they had some quite disappointing results. What the nationalists I spoke to here were really hoping for was a big surge in working class support from the poorer states, people who don't normally vote in elections. And they were hoping that would carry them to victory, or at least to a close defeat. And that didn't materialise in the way they hoped.
Is there any sense of why that didn't happen?
Not that I've picked up. Obviously, people will be picking over the numbers for days now. I think in part it's because we have to remember that for years, support for independence was rigidly stuck at about a third.
Yeah.
And so there was an element of double counting here where they'd already had an uplift to the mid-40s, even the high-40s in the polls. And they were still saying, we'll get a lot of the missing million, we'll get new voters, people who don't normally vote, and they'll take us beyond 50. Well, they'd already taken them to the 40s, so there weren't as many left as they thought.
And the hope was as well, because 16 and 17-year-olds were able to vote in this referendum. I think the hope there was that young people would vote for the first time and they'd vote for positive change, was the message from the campaign.
Yes, and actually they proved to be more conservative than the yes side hoped. So for those reasons, I think it looks, after the panic you've had at Westminster in the last few weeks, on paper it's quite a comfortable win. The no vote tops 2 million, and they got a double digit win.
And yet, just listening to Alex Salmond's concession speech this morning and Alistair Darling and David Cameron's statements, that isn't quite how it felt. Alex Salmond, although he lost and he accepted that very graciously, he was still talking about, you know, these are our demands and this is what we want to see happen.
Yeah. Absolutely. So he will extract a price for this defeat, and simply for their own standing and issues of trust. All of the party leaders have to stick rigidly to the timetable they've agreed now. I don't doubt that they will. I think the danger actually is that constitutional change is seen as a panacea, when I think actually the alienation that has led some to vote for the breakup of what is a very successful union is much deeper than that. It has economic and social roots. I don't think actually that many Scots are overwhelmed by the potential of Devo Max. I think they want something far more profound than that.
There was a symbolic message to the independence campaign that's now just sort of fizzled out. That's not on offer anymore.
Yes.
So as well as reactions from the leaders of the various campaigns in Scotland, we also had David Cameron and Ed Miliband, as you say, laying out this, what sounded to me, very ambitious timetable, given that issues like the West Lothian question have trickled on and on for decades now. Suggesting that we could have legislation by the end of the year seems unrealistic.
Yes, well, normally it would be unrealistic, but we're in such extraordinary circumstances here. The union, in many ways, has had a near-death experience. I think they will probably find a way to get it through, but Cameron's played a very political card by instantly gripping the English question, which everyone expected him to do. Obviously, Tories have been talking about this for a while. Cameron couldn't really address it explicitly until after the votes. And in some ways, it's an attempt to solve a genuine constitutional anomaly. So the West Lothian question, of course, was first posed by Labour MP Tamsin Ayel. It is the practice whereby you can have non-English MPs voting on English laws that don't affect their constituents. It's one academics and so on have wrangled with for decades. But there is a very political dimension to it, in that obviously Labour has far more Scottish and Welsh MPs than the Tories, and a lot of Conservatives recognise the potential to shackle a future Labour government by making it impossible for it to pass English legislation in the House if it doesn't have a majority of English MPs.
And you wrote on the New Statesman website this morning that it could have, for a Labour government, it could effectively hand a permanent veto to the Conservatives. And so everything from minor legislation right up to budgets and big important acts would then be in jeopardy.
Absolutely. And what was interesting about Cameron's statement is that he didn't just refer to the powers that the Scottish Parliament has had since it was created over education and health, for instance. He also referred to tax, to welfare, the real meat of government. And I know shadow cabinet ministers, particularly Ed Balls, are very nervous about this. And that's one reason why they were quite worried about the blank check that Scotland seemed to have been given in terms of devolution, because they knew that would mean the English question comes up again. And it's very difficult for Labour now to argue against English votes for English laws without being seen as the anti-English party. And the Tories are well aware that there's been an upsurge in English identity in recent years for a variety of reasons. And they see that as a political trend that they can mine.
And there's also, of course, when it comes to English identity, the issue of UKIP. Nigel Farage has been all over the airwaves this morning saying that he's now campaigning for fairness for English taxpayers and trying to position himself as the voice of the sort of the silent English majority or something, which presumably is further worrying for Labour, who are already concerned about the way UKIP is eating into their vote in some places.
Yes, I think there is a real danger for Miliband that he's the opposition leader. He is meant to embody change. Change is the word he was constantly using in his reaction speech today. But whenever the voters have a chance to vote for an anti-government party that isn't Labour, they seem to take it. So UKIP won the European elections. You had George Galloway win in Bradford. The Greens are eating into Labour's votes. And that means that there's a chance Labour won't win in 2015, or that they'll be the largest party, but it will be a very weak and potentially unpopular government. Now, of course, we're coming up to Labour conference, which has been an afterthought until now, but that is the big task for Miliband in his conference speech, is to somehow reclaim that insurgent mantle and to be seen as an agent of change, rather than as part of the Westminster elite, as part of the problem rather than the solution.
Well, with, as you say, with Labour conference this week and Miliband's speech forthcoming, it couldn't be a more crucial time. So we look forward to your reports, George. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the major consequences of the Scottish independence debate has been greater calls by the English regions for more powers. It was widely regarded that the devolution agenda had stalled when the North East Assembly was rejected in 2004. I'm joined by John Elledge and Philip Maughan to talk about what might happen now in the future about the regions getting more power. John, first of all, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Did I get the wrong date for the North East Assembly? I just suddenly thought, was it 2004, 2005?
I think it was 2004, but okay. As a confirmed southerner, I'm probably not the one to ask.
So. Okay, Phil, you're from the north.
Yeah, it was when I was doing my A-levels. So
When did you do your A-levels? I think this was an easier question for you than anyone else.
It was 2004.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. So we cleared that up. Okay, so tell me your memory of what happened then.
A lot of people were very grumpy and cynical. I think there is a great desire for representation in the northeast, particularly. You know, throughout Scotland, there's been nothing but kind of murmurings of, you know, well, they do pretty bloody well comparison to us. Mm. But the package that was offered was totally insubstantial. I think that it just looked like there was going to be very little change, a whole new level of bureaucracy kind of added, and that was sort of the line that went around at the time. And people just didn't think it was the right way to go about things. But I don't think that there was necessarily a kind of dismissal of even the idea of assemblies. I just think it was that it was bad timing. I mean, a very popular Labour government at the time as well needs to be added, and you know, the North East very Labour friendly.
I think that is a really interesting point. So James Ball over at The Guardian did some analysis of the number of times that Scotland was mentioned. You know, it was mentioned more than 2,000 times in London-based national newspapers in between 8th and 15th of September. In that same amount of time, Yorkshire, which has got a population, I found out, the same size as Scotland. It's got an economy twice the size of Wales. If it competed in the last Olympics as a separate country, it would have come 12th in the medals table.
Yeah, everyone was saying that at the time.
Everyone from Yorkshire.
Oh, sorry, yeah, by that I mean, yeah, everyone. Yeah.
And yet there were about 500 mentions of Yorkshire. So there is a point that when we talk about how overwhelmingly dominant England is within the current union, actually what we tend to mean is London and the South East. And actually Wales has got more self-determination than an English region. But John, you wrote a very Eeyore-ish piece for City Metric about why devolution never works, essentially because we, apart from Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, we don't have such clearly defined regions that you can kind of assign power specifically to them.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty you quickly run into is that if you start talking about the idea of a federal UK, you think of the four countries. The problem being that England is a whole order of magnitude bigger and more populous than any of the others. So, you know, an English parliament would pretty much just replicate the UK parliament with some of the bits cut off. And, you know, the idea of English-only votes in the House of Commons quickly runs into all sorts of practical issues, such as, you know, how do you define an English-only matter? And also the fact that there is a non-insignificant chance that you would end up with a UK government which doesn't have enough votes to get any of its English legislation through. So you move on to the idea of regional representation, at which point you run headlong into the idea that, you know, Yorkshire is quite a good example of a region that does have a very well-defined identity and a big population. And you can do the same.
Well, except I found out from the Yorkshire First website that they want to claim two counties from Lincolnshire as well.
That's the bit of Humberside south of the River Humber, I think, which is kind of very close.
And what's the logic there? Because there's a pretty big river. It's quite a good marker.
There's a pretty big bridge.
Humber Bridge, great bridge.
But it's this is actually a good point. I mean, it's
rampant
area.
Imperialism from Yorkshire. I think that's what it is. The same thing has happened with the Wessex Regional Party, which used to use Thomas Hardy's old definition of Wessex. It now also wants Oxfordshire and I can't remember what it's another
Gloucestershire. I think.
Gloucestershire. Oh. So basically, it's everybody decides their region gets to be quite big. They start getting grandiose. The Yorkshire Napoleon is
and
probably
you know
even
on the fringes of Yorkshire is where they're most ardently Yorkshire. So I'm from Middlesbrough, which is actually sort of straddles the Tees, and therefore, if you're on the north side, you're from County Durham. If you're from the south side, you're from North Yorkshire. And so along that fringe, the northern fringe, on the 1st of August, Yorkshire Day, ladies and gentlemen, the flags are out. It's like Northern Ireland.
It's like the Orange Day marches up there.
What happens on Yorkshire Day? Sorry,
scones and that. But I mean, everyone puts out, you know, the kind of white rose outside their kind of, and they're a nice little kind of, you know, some chutneys and nice little farmers markets and things. You know, I mean, it's just a kind of celebration of it's a rural life. I mean, Yorkshire's sort of known.
I've never felt more oppressed. There is no Midlands Day.
But Yorkshire's not the same thing. It's not a geographical region in that sense. It's a county. I mean, it's got history reaches longer
this
back
is,
than
this
the
is exactly the point, though. There is absolutely no way of breaking down England into kind of roughly equal regions that you could devolve power to, where everyone kind of recognises these things as, you know, a part of their identity. I think the problem is we do start talking about this debate in terms of identity when that's actually a bit of a red herring. We should be talking about power. The reason why all this is a big...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Transport funding, for example, goes to London. Is because somewhere in the Treasury there is an economic model which works out the kind of return on any investment, and because London is bigger and richer and there are a lot of bankers here, if you build another railway line in London, it looks like a good investment. You can make a lot of money out of this in terms of your kind of future economic return. But you can't make the same case for transport investment in Bradford or Birmingham. There is no Birmingham Tube.
Well, this is exactly what we've seen with the rail franchises, which is that everybody wants to run London to Manchester, London to Birmingham. Nobody wants to run the intercity service that runs through Chipping, Salisbury, or, you know, and there's still no, I mean, loads of places still don't have a railway line. I was talking to somebody from who's campaigning for a Cornish Assembly, and he said, well, the thing is, when we had the big storms at the beginning of the year, people talked about the main railway line between London and Cornwall being down. It was the only railway line. Mm-hmm. You know, Cornwall doesn't have a motorway. It's very hard to get from South Wales to North Wales. Trying to do that on public transport, I think, would probably take you about 15 hours.
I think you have to go via Birmingham or something ridiculous. But the point is, the Treasury is never going to look at the maths and think, right, there's a really good investment to make in building another line to Cornwall. Some kind of Cornish Assembly, if it could scrape the money together, probably would see that as a good investment. It would mean that suddenly this infrastructure was not competing with whatever the big project from London was. That, I think, is the real case for devolution. But nobody's willing to make it because you quickly run into sort of hatred of the entire political class and all these identity problems.
But also about billions.
About Sir John, you know, editor of City Metric. What do you think about city mayors? Do they attract this kind of investment business to cities? Are they good spokespeople for their cities and towns?
It depends on how you do it. I mean, if you look at like the American mayoral system. Or the French mayoral system.
Which gives
a
background, which is that lots of people were offered the chance for elected mayors a few years ago, and most of pretty much everybody turned them down. So people didn't want them, is the background.
I think in London, the position of mayor has kind of been a success, but it's not actually that powerful a position, considering it's elected by a single constituency of 8 million people. The reason it attracts these kind of flamboyant, slightly outsider political characters is because it functions more as kind of, you know, a bully pulpit or a stage. It's somewhere you can kind of make the case for investing in London, but you still don't have massive amounts of fiscal power.
Do you think
own.
It's more like being a governor of an American state then?
No, because governors also actually have quite a lot of political power. It's almost more sort of a symbolic than that, I think.
Are you a fundraiser of sorts, a sort of kind of, you know, you're the public relations man.
To a certain extent. I mean, that's how Ken Livingstone got a lot done, by going round sort of banging the drum for investing in London. Boris Johnson has kind of followed the same line in a sort of slightly
different
way.
Chipping over the drum, kind of drawing a smiley face on it.
Yeah, but I mean, where there have been kind of big transport projects that have happened under the Johnson administration, it's largely been where he could personally go out and sort of persuade, you know, the Emirates or whoever it is, that this is something worth investing in. It's almost more a sort of, you know, chairman of the board role than a sort of presidential style one, I think.
I thought, Gordon Brown's been having something of a renaissance, and he was having a great he gave a great kind of spiel on the programme with Dimbleby, David Dimbleby, where he was talking about exactly the problem of regionalisation, which is that different bits of public spending go to different parts of the country. So there are some parts of the country which need far more spending in terms of unemployment benefits, for example. London soaks up hugely disproportionately amount of housing benefit because London housing is so actually, although it looks very unfair on the surface that some people get more money than others, actually it's about what each particular region needs, and that sort of evens itself out. And I think there is a big question. Actually, some powers you almost don't want to devolve down. If you think about the trouble that the coalition has had over planning, for example, devolving planning permission down means essentially no one's going to build anything because no one wants to. All the incentives there are to maintain the land that you've got, maintain the house prices for the people who've already got houses. Nobody wants a big giant estate built on them or huge swathes of concrete over the countryside or whatever, however you want to frame it. Those things have to be centrally imposed. The same thing with the problem with HS2. That's going through the constituencies of a lot of disgruntled Tories like Michael Fabricant. And actually, if that decision were taken at the local level, no one would ever want to make themselves that unpopular, even if the overall benefit for the country is actually demonstrable.
It's the tragedy of the commons, isn't it? It's, you know, the benefits are widely spread, whereas the costs are concentrated in an incredibly small number of people, all of whom vote for the same politicians. Yeah, I mean, I think the housing point is a very interesting one. There was a depressing moment the other week where a report came out backed by the centre-right think tank Policy Exchange, which had given out an award to the best idea for a garden city. And the winner was this plan for this fictitious city called Uxchester. But basically, it amounted to doubling the size of Oxford. And they got quite detailed plans of how you'd do it, just to maintain green space and ensure it was built around public transport and so on. And, you know, as these things go, it was quite an impressive plan. And Brandon Lewis, the housing minister, pretty much instantaneously put out a report just absolutely trashing it and saying, you know, this kind of thing is never going to happen. We're not going to make Labour's mistakes of imposing housing top down. It's going to be bottom up from the communities. And you quickly run into the problem that you've just described, Helen, which is that
if you've got a house,
you don't want more houses next door. Yeah,
you'd
much rather keep your view of the Cotswolds than get a nice view of the housing estate instead. And if we're reliant on communities to sort of suddenly decide to build houses, then we are never, ever going to fix this problem. Without wanting to sound like a sort of old-fashioned statist, I really think this is something that has to come from Westminster.
Well, on that slightly depressing, but I'm impressed we talked about devolution for so long. Who knew? Maybe we'll make it a regular feature.
I keep telling people devolution is really interesting, but then they kind of walk away from me and don't talk to me again.
So it's the new independence.
Come back and talk about the EU again, they say, John. All is forgiven. I'll say thank you very much to Philip Moore and John Elledge. Well, from the English regions to outer space, I'm joined by Ian Steadman and Fiona Rutherford to talk about NASA's new contracts for private companies to take astronauts to the International Space Station. Ian, we know that private companies have done pretty well so far. The SpaceX Dragon has been ferrying supplies to the ISS. What's the new update on that?
Well, this is part of a kind of larger international thing where private companies are increasingly being trusted with space exploration. So the history to this is kind of, you know, during the Cold War, it was all about very centralized. You had the Americans and you had the Russians, and they were kind of spending a lot of their own state budgets on sending people to space and going to the moon and all those famous things. But since then, governments don't really like spending as much money on space travel, but the private sector has realized that there's a lot of potential for earning money from up there. In the future, people talk about things like asteroid mining and building bases on the moon, which is quite exciting. But until we get there, we need to sort of develop a private space industry. And that's kind of what's happened, where NASA has started to outsource contracts to private companies to do things like basically send supplies up to the International Space Station. And now what the contract that's just been announced this week is to send astronauts up to the ISS.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but SpaceX is Elon Musk's company.
Yes, the famous Elon Musk.
So Elon Musk was involved in the founding of eBay. PayPal.
He's
involved in the founding of PayPal,
made
the online
a huge amount of money from
payment
PayPal.
Service. He then also is involved with Tesla, which does electric cars.
Yeah.
And he famously said, "I want to die on Mars, just not on impact."
He's also behind the idea to send people to Mars for the first Martian colony. He's a very ambitious man who has he's inspired the Iron Man character in modern times.
Tony Stark.
Well, because Tony Stark predates Elon Musk being born, as far as I'm aware. Yeah. But the more modern incarnations,
Robert Downey Jr.
In the films, for instance. Yeah.
Billionaire.
Yeah, so SpaceX is his company, but Boeing, which is, Boeing's a massive company, but they've also earned these contracts that are like $7 billion. And it's just test flights at the moment. And then possibly up to half a dozen actual flights of astronauts up to the ISS. But SpaceX has already been sending up supply missions to the ISS. They've got this Dragon spacecraft, which is their own rocket that they've developed. They do test flights in the Nevada desert. They are doing quite a good job.
I'm excited about this. One of the things I think is really interesting about Boeing and Airbus as well, I think that they give them planes deliberately really boring names.
Yeah.
The other thing that's about Airbus is that you could have called it like the Falcon or something like that, but no, you would deliberately want it to be really boring.
It doesn't look like a Falcon either. A Falcon implies it's quite sort of fast and graceful, but the Airbus A380 is more like a bus. Whale with wings. It's huge.
So I wonder when they start taking people up to space, if they'll stop, if SpaceX will drop names like the Dragon and it'll be called like the sort of tram, space tram.
The space, like, airport shuttle or something, really
just
boring.
Yeah, something really nice and kind of like...
Yeah.
I think they're calling it the space taxis.
Yeah, they are. They're calling them space taxis, actually, so...
See, that's entirely proves my theory that it's going to be as boring as possible. I mean, Fiona, do you think this marks a new, exciting era, or do you think we're really going to need, the kind of huge amounts of cash that only governments can stump up?
I think it is quite exciting, but I think the reason why America's doing it is to get away from relying on Russia because of the events in Ukraine.
Yeah, there was a Russian cosmonaut and on the ISS, wasn't there, time of the Ukraine incursion, which must have been... Because they speak English and Russian, and everyone has to learn, and they launched from Kazakhstan and Star City.
The current crew on the ISS is 3 Russians, 2 Americans, and
I think there's one Japanese guy who
astronaut.
Like,
yeah,
this is uncomfortable.
He's the commander, actually, so his job will be keeping them all from fighting like children, I guess. But there is that weird reintroduction of the political element to space, because at the moment you can only get up there in the Russian Soyuz.
Yeah, and they charge a lot of money.
They charge a huge amount of money for it.
And it's really sad because it's much smaller than the American Challenger and things that they were using that. So there was a whole raft of astronauts who were like 6'1", 6'2", and suddenly that was it. Well, sorry about your 20 years of training, lads, but you're too tall. Ian, you would no longer be allowed to go up to space. You're too tall.
No, I absolutely wouldn't.
I get motion sick on the cross-country ferry, so I'm also ruled out from this.
So this is, I mean, the Americans all really want to avoid having to rely on the Russians, particularly if the Russians have also, they've said that they might detach, we talked about this in a previous podcast a few months ago, they want to detach their bits of the ISS from the ISS in 2020 so they can use it as the core of their own new space station that's not sort of like everyone else's. Because at the moment the ISS is, lots of bits from different countries all bolted together. But the core component that has the life support and everything is Russian. And they basically said they want to take their ball and play by themselves and go home. So they're going to let all the American bits fall into the atmosphere and burn up. And they can go create their own new space station.
Wow.
So there is that weird political thing that's come back into space travel.
That is fascinating, because that was the defining metaphor of this idea of the space race. And then I interviewed Chris Hadfield, who's a Canadian astronaut. And he said, one of the things that's now different is that it's now very much about cooperation. So not only is it about cooperation from all the different nations that, send up people, but also actually the whole ethos of what it takes to be an astronaut has changed, because they're flying such longer missions. The Right Stuff era, these were test pilots. These were kind of really scary, Tom Cruise and Top Gun kind of, real alpha males. And actually that's not what they want anymore, because if you're stuck, I think Tom Cruise's character in Top Gun, if you had been stuck in a tiny tin can with him for like 18 months, there would be an insurrection. So everybody's much more kind of chilled out in space now. And actually they were talking about the Mars mission. They're thinking that what they want is to have is a middle-aged married couple.
Yeah.
On the basis that they'd be used to sort of pottering around, spending a lot of time with each other, and wouldn't be at each other's throats. But I think that's quite sad, because that to me is a much more chilled out version of space.
It is, but that's kind of what happened. That's like colonization and exploration has always been like that. There's the exciting first wave of like we've discovered something new, and now it's to the boring bit of sort of building things and stuff, which is exciting in its own way. You know, building a moon base or building a base on Mars is going to be exciting. It's just that the people doing it might not necessarily be the most exciting individuals.
I've been on the moon this weekend on Destiny, the new computer game.
Oh, right.
And I have to tell you that it's really rubbish.
Oh, is it?
It's basically just like Halo.
I haven't got the latest consoles to play it on, unfortunately. Yeah. Well, I'm a PC gamer, but I have had a lot. My Twitter timeline is just people talking about it.
Well, I'm sure the listeners of the podcast don't need to hear me banging on about my problems with other things that I've been watching on TV, meals that I've cooked, etc. So we'll probably leave it there and say thank you very much to Fiona and Ian. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Moore.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.